Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. Open your Bible and join us as we dig into the Word. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
Welcome to Wednesday, those of you that are here. I think after tonight, after months and months and months, did I mention the months part?
Months.
After months of leaving the Israelites, standing at the foot of Mount Sinai, we are in within a week of getting these people moving. We're about to get them trekking across the desert on their way toward the promised land. But we have to cover just a couple more things. Now, chapter 7 is a very long, very repetitive chapter, so we're going to survey that. Chapter 6 is about the law of the Nazarites. So we will start there and talk about the Nazarites. So chapter 6 of the book of Numbers in your Old Testament is where we're starting tonight. The concept behind a Nazarite vow was, as we saw the last couple of weeks, God chose one tribe, the Levites, and he used the Levites to replace all the firstborn of Israel, who were technically his after the killing of all the firstborn of the Egyptians when God delivered Israel out of Egypt. But then out of all the other tribes, out of all the sons of Israel, if there was someone who was moved to serve God, they weren't excluded from it just because God had chosen the Levites to do the day-to-day work around the temple. And you could take a vow that was known as a Nazarite vow. Now, this is not a Nazarene vow. These are two different things. A Nazarene is someone from Nazareth. Nazarite is a word that means to be separated. And so there are a couple of very famous Nazarites in the Old Testament. Can you think of any?
Samson.
Samson, very famous Nazarite. Ted Nugent look-alike. Yeah. John the Baptist was probably a Nazarite, given everything that the angel told his father about how he would live. As we read through the Nazarite requirements here, you'll recognize the similarities between what is said here.
Samuel?
Was Samuel a Nazarite? Yeah, I believe Samuel was, because he was separated. His mother gave him up, and then he was separated to God. I'm going to go with yes on Samuel. Chapter 6, verse 1 starts here. Again the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when a man or a woman makes a special vow, the vow of a Nazarite, to dedicate himself to the Lord, he shall abstain from wine and strong drink. He shall drink no vinegar, whether made from wine or strong drink. Neither shall he drink any grape juice, nor eat fresh or dried grapes. All the days of his separation, he shall not eat anything that is produced by the grapevine, from the seeds even to the skins. All the days of his vow of separation, no razor shall pass over his head. He shall be holy until the days are fulfilled from which he separated himself to the Lord. He shall let the locks of his hair grow long. All the days of his separation to the Lord, he shall not go near to a dead person. He shall not make himself unclean for his father or for his mother, for his brother or for his sister when they die, because his separation to God is on his head. All the days of his separation, he is holy to the Lord. But if a man dies very suddenly beside him, and he defiles his dedicated hair of his head, then he shall shave his head on the day when he becomes clean. He shall shave it on the seventh day. Then on the eighth day, he shall bring two turtle doves and two young pigeons to the priest to the doorway of the tent of meeting. And the priest shall offer one for a sin offering and the other for a burnt offering to make atonement for him concerning his sin because of the dead person. And the same day, he shall consecrate his head and shall dedicate to the Lord his days as a Nazarite, and shall bring a male lamb of a year old for a guilt offering, but the former days shall be void because his separation was defiled. Now this is the law of the Nazarite. When the days of his separation are fulfilled, he shall bring the offering to the doorway of the tent of meeting, And he shall present his offering to the Lord, one male lamb, a year old, without defect, for a burnt offering, and one ewe lamb, a year old, without defect, for a sin offering, and one ram, without defect, for a peace offering. And a basket of unleavened cakes of fine flour mixed with oil, and unleavened wafers spread with oil, along with their grain offering and their libations. And the priest shall present them before the Lord, and shall offer his sin offering and his burnt offering. He shall also offer the ram for a sacrifice of peace offerings to the Lord. Together with a basket of unleavened cakes, the priest shall likewise offer its grain offerings and its libation. The Nazarite shall then shave his dedicated hair of his head at the doorway of the tent of meeting, and take the dedicated hair of his head and put it on the fire, which is under the sacrifice of peace offerings. And the priest shall take the ram's shoulder when it has been boiled, and one unleavened cake out of the basket, and one unleavened wafer, and shall put them in the hands of the Nazarite after he has shaved his dedicated hair. Then the priest shall wave them for a wave offering before the Lord. It is holy to the priest, together with the breast offered by waving and the thigh offered by lifting up, and afterward the Nazarite may drink wine. This is the law of the Nazarite, who vows his offering to the Lord according to his separation, in addition to what else he can afford, according to his vows which he takes, so he shall do according to the law of his separation. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Speak to Aaron and to his sons, saying, Thus you shall bless the sons of Israel, and you shall say this to them. We'll get to verse 24 in a moment. Did someone have a question? Did I hear something?
I did. As I remember, Samuel was offered as a Nazarite by his mother.
Yeah, they were given over to be separated, and that's the point of the word Nazarite, is to be separated unto the Lord. And the deal with Samuel was that his mother had prayed, saying, if you give me a child, I will dedicate him. I will separate him to the Lord.
But didn't Samuel's mother, wasn't she, didn't something appear, the Lord appear to her or something, and tell her that she was...
Samson's mother.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so in their cases, yes, they were told, which is why I said even John the Baptist was told, or his father was told by an angel, that he would follow these same rules. No strong drink, don't cut your hair, be separated to God your whole life. And this is the idea of a voluntary vow, a Nazarite vow, that anybody within Israel could do. But in some instances, like you've just mentioned, like Samson, like Samuel, especially like John the Baptist, God chose them out and said, you're separated to me. The point behind the Nazarite vow here in the book of Numbers is that even though God had chosen a particular tribe and said, you will serve me as a separate tribe, that didn't keep the rest of the children of Israel from being able to separate themselves or serve God. But they didn't have to do it their whole lives, as you saw. They could separate themselves for a period of time, take a vow, and then at the end of that, they would shave their head. You may also recall that Paul, in the book of Acts, when he went and met with John and James and the leaders in Jerusalem, that James said, look at all these men here who are dedicated to the law of Moses and yet believe. What are you going to say to them? They're going to come together. There's going to be an argument. Do this. Take a vow with them. Have your days of purification, shave your head, sacrifice an animal. So there's a possibility that even that vow that Paul took in the book of Acts was a voluntary separation Nazarite type of vow. This was put in place so that Israelites could voluntarily serve God for a period of their life. And during that time, they'd be marked out by their hair and by their particular diet, not touching anything of the grape or any kind of drink or strong drink. Now, when I was growing up in the Lutheran church, at the end of every service, there was a blessing that the minister would always say. You're agreeing. You're probably familiar with these words.
Oh, exactly. I love them.
These are words that have resonated through time and have resonated to all the people of God. I think it's one of the best blessings anywhere in the Bible. And it's just tucked away here in the book of Numbers at the end of chapter 6. At the end of the Nazarite vow, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Speak to Aaron and to his sons, saying, Thus you shall bless the sons of Israel. I used to actually say this blessing over my children when they were young. I used to say, The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine on you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance on you and give you peace. Isn't that a great blessing? To bless you, to keep you, to make his face shine on you and be gracious to you. I find it interesting that in the book of Numbers, especially in the midst of all the laws we've been reading, all the Exodus stuff, all the Leviticus stuff, after this book you get into the Deuteronomical law. After all these laws and rules and regulations, when it came time for God to say, now put a blessing on Israel, that the blessing included, God be gracious to you. And you'll notice that nowhere in the blessing is there, now keep every rule and keep every law and you'll get my blessing. The blessing in the book of Numbers is a blessing of grace, because God ultimately is a God of grace. The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. So they shall invoke my name on the sons of Israel, and I then will bless them. Right behind that wonderful blessing, God immediately then takes up an offering. Now, this is no meager offering. We're going to read the first of the 12 successive offerings, and then we're going to read the summation of what the 12 days of offering entailed. And then we're going to talk about why God imposed this kind of offering on Israel. Chapter 7, verse 1 says, "Now it came about on the day that Moses had finished setting up the tabernacle, that he anointed it and consecrated it with all its furnishings and the altar and all its utensils. He anointed them and he consecrated them also. Then the leaders of Israel, the heads of their fathers' households, made an offering. They were the leaders of the tribes. They were the ones who were over the numbered men. When they brought their offering before the Lord, 6 covered carts and 12 oxen, a cart for every 2 of the leaders, and an ox for each one, they then presented them before the tabernacle. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, 'Accept these things from them, that they may be used in the service of the tent of meeting. And you shall give them to the Levites, to each man according to his service.'" So here's a great plan. Since we've just been told what each of the tribes of Levi was going to be responsible for in terms of the tabernacle, and all of the poles, and all of the crossbeams, and all of the curtains, and all of the furniture, having ox carts is going to be really helpful. And so God provides them with a way to travel all that stuff. But verse 6, "Moses took the carts and the oxen, and he gave them to the Levites, 2 carts and 4 oxen he gave to the sons of Gershon according to their service. 4 carts and 8 oxen he gave to the sons of Merari for their service under the direction of Ithamar, the son of Aaron the priest. But he did not give any to the sons of Kohath, because theirs was the service of the holy objects, which they carried on their shoulder." That's an important point. You remember that a couple of the items, the Ark of the Covenant, the laver of cleansing, the altar itself, couldn't be put on a cart or carried by an animal. It had to be carried on the shoulders of the Levites. In other words, God placed a burden on the shoulders of these people that he chose. He didn't just choose them and say, "Now it's picnic time." He chose them and said, "The service I am requiring from you is going to be a burden to you, and you're going to carry it on your shoulders." And right from there, verse 11, "Then the Lord said to Moses, 'Let them present their offering, 1 liter each day for a dedication of the altar.'" Now follow the details here, because the details are important. Put shoe leather on this. Try to imagine the amount of stuff we're talking about. Verse 12, "Now the one who presented his offering on the first day was Nashon, the son of Amminadab of the tribe of Judah. His offering was 1 silver dish, whose weight was 130 shekels, 1 silver bowl of 70 shekels, according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering. one golden pan of 10 shekels full of incense, one bull, one ram, one male lamb 1 year old for a burnt offering, one male goat for a sin offering, and for the sacrifice of peace offerings, 2 oxen, 5 rams, 5 male goats, 5 male lambs 1 year old. That was the offering of one of the 12 people. Multiply that all out by 12, move to the end of the chapter, and let's start at verse 84. The rest of that chapter is going to tell you day by day for 12 days that each of the leaders of each of the tribes brought that size offering. And then it is summed up starting in verse 84. This was the dedication offering for the altar from the leaders of Israel when it was anointed. This is all about the fact that God has joined his people, the people who he chose out of all the earth, that God has delivered those people out of Egypt, has given them his law, has given them his priesthood, has given them the methodology to approach him. And now that they are able to approach him without being killed, he then is going to create the dedication of the altar. This is the place where substitutionary atonement takes place. This is where the altar for sin, or the death of animals in the place of the Israelites for sin, takes place. This is the center of their entire religious experience with God. The altar where sin gets paid for, where reconciliation is made, where atonement is accomplished, the altar. And so when it came time to dedicate the altar, this is what it took. This was the dedication of the altar of the leaders of Israel when it was anointed. 12 silver dishes, 12 silver bowls, 12 gold pans, each silver dish weighing 130 shekels, and each bowl 70 shekels. All the silver of the utensils was 2,400 shekels, according to the shekel of the sanctuary. The 12 gold pans full of incense, weighing 10 shekels apiece, according to the shekel of the sanctuary, all the gold of the pans, 120 shekels. All the oxen for the burnt offering, 12 bulls. All the rams, 12. The male lambs, 1 year old, with their grain offering, 12. And the male goats for a sin offering, 12. And all the oxen for the sacrifice of peace offering, 24 bulls. All the rams, 60, all the male goats, 60, and the male lambs, 1 year old, 60. This was the dedication offering for the altar after it was anointed, for one piece of furniture. For one piece of furniture where atonement could be made. The one piece of furniture on which God was going to teach the sacrifice and atonement for sin required all of that. Gold and silver and incense and blood, 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 blood. Lots and lots of blood because there was lots and lots of sin. Now notice also that when God was in the midst of his people, he did not want to be taken lightly. Notice that he was not taken casually. When it came to his service, he laid himself like a burden on their shoulders. And when it came time to dedicate his altar, the offering he required was enormous. Because God is not meant to be taken lightly. Has God changed?
No.
No. God has not changed. So then, we like to think that because we're under this covenant of grace, somehow the character or the majesty or the separateness or the holiness of God's presence has now become such a casual thing that you can kind of take it or leave it. And that though we say God is in our midst, and not just in our midst, but in ourselves by his Holy Spirit, that he has taken up residence in us, that we are now the tabernacles, the temples of God in which God himself dwells, and yet we will take that so haphazardly, so casually, that we will forget that when he was dealing with Israel and doing it on an external basis, he made sure that every day, every day, every day, there were offerings and there were sacrifices. And even when it came time to dedicate the piece of furniture, that it was the center of his worship, he made sure that there was nonstop offering and money and blood and sacrifice to dedicate his place of sacrifice. That really ought to be a lesson to us. That really ought to wake us up one more time to the reality that if God has graciously interrupted your life, if for some reason you care about the things of God, if for some reason you have discovered that you can't escape him, try though you might, if you have found out that God is in your midst, then he also is able to put expectations and burdens on you. He is able to say, you're mine, you're separate. You're different. You're my people. And because you're my people, I can lay burdens on you and expect you to carry those burdens. Has God ever changed? No. Is God still the same God who required this of Israel? Yes. And yet that same God, out of phenomenal grace, would allow Paul to say things like, let every man give according as he purposes in his heart. We have this marvelous grace that we've been given so that we can react to God according to how he moves on our heart. Me personally, I think that that grace and this covenant and this promise of salvation by grace through faith, having the kind of security that Israelites never had, that that ought to drive us to a greater emphasis on the reality of God in our lives, not a lesser emphasis. Mm-hmm. If the Israelites had to do all this external exercise and bring all these animals and these plates and this gold and this incense to dedicate the place where the sacrifice was going to be given over and over and over, pointing toward the ultimate sacrifice of Christ, then I think we who live on the other side of that sacrifice ought to be eternally grateful for the fact that the sacrifice came, and we certainly shouldn't be any less aware than the Israelites were. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, chapter 8 starts. We are moving now. We're getting very close to chapter 10, and then we are going to travel these Israelites away from Mount Sinai. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to Aaron and say to him, when you mount the lamps, the seven lamps will give light in the front of the lampstand. Aaron therefore did so. He mounted its lamps at the front of the lampstand, just as the Lord commanded Moses. Now this was the workmanship of the lampstand, hammered work of gold from its base to its flowers. It was hammered work according to the pattern which the Lord had shown Moses, so he made the lampstand. And again the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, take the Levites from among the sons of Israel and cleanse them. And thus you shall do to them, for their cleansing sprinkle purifying water on them, and let them use a razor over their whole body, and wash their clothes, and they shall be clean. And let them take a bull with its grain offering, fine flour mixed with oil, and a second bull you shall take for a sin offering. Didn't we just get done with a whole bunch of offerings? Mm-hmm. All those offerings were for the other 12 tribes. They didn't even count for the Levites. Now we're dealing with cleansing the Levites, and all the offerings start again. Have you noticed that every time God deals with people, his people, there's offerings involved? I know that that sounds self-serving to keep pointing out, but it's true. So he says, let them take a bull with its grain offering, fine flour mixed with oil, and a second bull you shall take for a sin offering. So you shall present the Levites before the tent of meeting, and you shall also assemble the whole congregation of the sons of Israel, and present the Levites before the Lord, and the sons of Israel shall lay their hands on the Levites. What does that signify? Why would God have the other 12 tribes laying hands on the Levites?
Because the other 12 had already been cleansed, and now they were doing that for the Levites?
The transference is there, but what's the transference?
The firstborn.
the transference of all their firstborn to the Levites, so that the Levites now have the responsibility of serving on behalf of the 12 tribes. The Levites, in other words, now think this through, because where else did you ever see laying on hands as a form of transference?
The sin
offerings, the scapegoat, all of those places where you saw sacrifice. So what has God done with the tribe of Levi at this point? No, he's redeeming them in the sacrifices. And then once they are clean, God is having the other 12 tribes lay hands on the Levites, transferring the responsibility to the Levites of the other 12 tribes. And so Levi becomes a sacrifice out of the whole nation of Israel dedicated to God, and dedicated to God by the other 12 tribes for the work of God. So you shall present, look verse 9, so you shall present the Levites before the tent of meeting. You shall also assemble the whole congregation of the sons of Israel and present the Levites before the Lord, and the sons of Israel shall lay their hands on the Levites, and Aaron shall then present the Levites before the Lord, look at this, as a wave offering from the sons of Israel, that they may qualify to perform the service of the Lord. So God took the Levites to himself and then made them into a wave offering for God on behalf of the other 12 tribes. Did the other 12 tribes choose to give Levi to God? No. Did Levi choose to give Levi to God? No. How did the Levites end up in God's service? God chose them because, just like every other sacrifice we saw, God has to be the one to prescribe the sacrifice, to choose the sacrifice, to tell you what the acceptable sacrifice is, and then tell you how to do the sacrifice, and then he'll accept it. This, again, is just an absolutely sovereign God. We see it all the way through the Old Testament. He says, if you're going to approach me, this is how you do it. Now, of course, he didn't make the Levites a sin sacrifice because that would require death. Instead, they became a wave offering, which means they were like a grain that would be waved before the Lord as a way of saying, this is dedicated to you and to your work. But God chose them, and then God dedicated them, and then God told the Israelites, lay hands on them, and they will do the service on your behalf, and I will accept them in your place. That's why the Levites were able to camp right up around the tabernacle, where the presence of God was going to be, and the other 12 tribes had to be afar off, had to be at a distance. They had to have that buffer of a dedicated tribe between them and God, or else the holiness of God would destroy them. What does that tell you? You don't get to just go pouncing into God's presence. Pouncing was the verb I went with, like your Tigger or something. You don't get to just go raging into God's presence and say, here, it's me, accept me. You have got to have some kind of buffer or some kind of advocate, somebody to stand in the gap between you and God, or else the absolute holiness and righteousness of God would destroy you because you're
sinful.
You or sinful. Either one works. They're both you. And so God teaches that here with the Levites, dedicates the Levites, has the 12 tribes put their hands on the Levites, and then the Levites do the work in their place. That takes us to verse 12. Now the Levites shall lay their hands on the heads of a bull. Transference again. Now the Levites lay their hands on the heads of a bull, or on the heads of bulls, and then they offer the one for a sin offering and the other for a burnt offering to the Lord to make atonement for the Levites. And you shall have the Levites stand before Aaron and before his sons so as to present them as a wave offering to the Lord. Thus you shall separate the Levites from among the sons of Israel. The Levites shall be mine. Verse 15 says, then after that the Levites may go in to serve the tent of meeting, but you shall cleanse them and present them as a wave offering. Now, what would have happened if any of these men had gone into the tent of meeting before they had been cleansed and purified and an atonement was made for them?
Zapped,
a good biblical term. God would have killed them because God is very jealous about his holiness. God is very jealous for his namesake, and God is very clear in saying, you can't just charge into my presence. You can only go into God's presence if God himself has given you the method to do it. Yes, sir?
Question.
Sure.
All right. If one of them is the tribe, the whole tribe, let's say that you are one of the tribe leader, right? And then I am in your tribe, mm-hmm. and I sin, so I die. And then the tribe keep pure. If one of them fail.
You know what? Interestingly, in some instances, yes, the tribe continues to be sanctified to God. But we're still talking about human beings here, despite the fact that God went through all this trouble in order to sanctify these people to himself. We know from the history of Israel that they're going to break all these rules. They're going to rebel against him the whole time, despite the fact that he's given them all these rules. And then he's going to scatter them. And to this day, the northern 12 tribes have been scattered out of their land and lost their heritage.
The northern 10 tribes.
The northern 10 tribes. What did I say?
12.
Oh, the northern 10 tribes have been scattered and lost their heritage. It's a good thing somebody's listening. Which is why it's so vitally important that we understand the example of the Israelites and their inability, even though God said, here's how you do it. If you want to please me, here's how you do it. And left to themselves, none of them could do it. So what does that tell you about human nature? What does that tell you about human beings?
You can really trust them.
Yeah, you can really trust people, huh? Yeah, no matter how many times God says, this is what holiness would look like, humans can't do it. And that is why the Christian atonement of Christ, Jesus on the cross, the once-for-all sacrifice, that's why it's so important, because now, instead of God looking to us for perfect performance, he looks to Christ's perfect performance and imputes that to you. So the same way that the Israelites would put their hands on the Levites and say, our responsibility is now on you, God did the same thing with all Christians and took our responsibility and laid it on Christ. And he, as our perfect substitute, did everything that was necessary to satisfy God, which is why the gospel is good news.
Yes.
Because you've got this whole Old Testament full of God saying, here, try it, go ahead. You know, here's the rules, here's the laws, 600 laws, try to keep them, go ahead. Oh, and if you break any one of them, you're guilty forever. Well, if that tells us anything, it tells us that people can't do that. And so then we're either destitute, desperate, have no way out, or God provides a perfect substitute, which is what he was teaching all the way through here, that eventually there would be a perfect sacrifice. Eventually, instead of hundreds of bulls and goats and lambs and sheep and thousands of birds over the years, all those sacrifices, according to the writer of Hebrews, never took away sin. All they did was keep God's wrath at bay till Christ got here. But once Christ came, the perfect substitute perfected forever all those that he sanctified. That's what the writer of Hebrews says. That's the exact language. Perfected forever those that he sanctified. The law could never do it. Christ could. So, I forget what your original question was. Oh, about whether a person's sin could make a whole tribe impure.
It depended on what the sin is. There were requirements in the law for certain
right.
sins.
Right. There were greater and lesser sins. There were those you could be stoned for. There were those that you could just be cleaned up for. But the point is, no matter what any Israelite did, he was never going to be good enough. There were no perfect Israelites.
But they didn't know that.
But they didn't know that. They found out, though, during that 40-year journey when they all died. Yeah, it seemed like a clue. Did that kind of answer your question?
That's it.
Okay. Verse 12. So the Levites lay their hands on the heads of the bulls, and they offer them for a burnt offering and to make atonement for the Levites. Verse 13, and you shall have the Levites stand before Aaron and before his sons and present them as a wave offering. Thus you shall separate the Levites from among the sons of Israel, and the Levites are mine. Then after that, the Levites may go in to serve in the temple of meeting, but you shall cleanse them and present them as a wave offering, for they are completely given to me from among the sons of Israel. I have taken them for myself instead of every first issue of the womb, the firstborn of all the sons of Israel. We just agreed a few minutes ago that God doesn't change. Does God still have the right then and the proclivity? Does God still take people to himself and say, you're mine?
He does.
Yeah, he does. He absolutely does. The difference between the people on the planet who care and the people who don't care is that God chooses some people. The fact that some people have the Holy Spirit, whom Jesus said in his high priestly prayer in John 17, he spoke of the Holy Spirit and said, whom the world, know the next word? The world cannot receive. Can't get it, can't do it. And yet he says, and you will receive him, and he'll be with you, and he'll be in you. Those people whom God chooses, he puts his Spirit in, sealing them for eternity, putting faith into them, driving them to repentance, and securing them in the finished work of Christ. No Israelite ever had that kind of promise. No Israelite ever had that kind of security. But God has always, in dealing with human beings, always exercised his right to say, you're mine. And from that point forward, you're his. And you can try to not be his, and you're going to end up his. And you can try to run away, and he's faster than you. David went so far as to say, if I make my bed in hell, behold, thou art there. No matter where you go, he said of God, you know when I stand up, you know when I sit down, you know my thoughts afar off. That's the kind of intimacy God has with the people he has chosen to himself.
He knows the words in your mouth
before you speak them, he knows them. So that means that when you're thinking about running away, he already knows you're thinking about running away. And he'll get ahead of you. For every firstborn, said verse 17, for every firstborn among the sons of Israel is mine, among the men and among the animals. On the day that I struck down all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, I sanctified them for myself. I sanctified them for myself. Isn't that an important phrase? I separated them for myself. I took them for myself. I'm the God who can say, these are mine. Don't touch them. They belong to me. But I've taken the Levites instead of every firstborn among the sons of Israel, and I've given the Levites as a gift to Aaron and to his sons from among the sons of Israel, to perform the service of the sons of Israel at the tent of meeting, and to make atonement on behalf of the sons of Israel, that there be no plague among the sons of Israel by their coming near to the sanctuary. That's a frightening phrase. Did you notice that God just said, the reason I'm putting the Levites in place is so that if the rest of you came near the sanctuary, there wouldn't be a plague. Now let's see, what did the last plague do that he caused? Oh, that's right, killed all the firstborn. So God's driving home this point that I think we just so easily forget because we become familiar with God. Because we start thinking of Jesus as my buddy and my homeboy and my co-pilot and my best friend, and Jesus is my boyfriend. And you start thinking of him that way, you forget that you're dealing with a God who is so phenomenally holy and righteous that if he didn't do something to protect you from himself, his holiness would kill you. And you can't do anything about his holiness. And you can't make yourself holy enough to stand in his presence. So if anybody is going to fix that, it has to be him. Because you can't do anything about it. And yet, phenomenal grace, he provided a way for sinful human beings to stand in front of him and not fry. And the way that he did it was what we've been reading Sunday mornings out of the book of John. Jesus saying, I'm the way. Want to know how to get to God? No man comes to the Father but by me. I'm the way, I'm the truth, I'm the life. This Sunday we're going to hear him say, I'm the resurrection and the life. So Jesus puts himself at the center of the religious universe and says, your relationship with God is completely dependent on what you think of me and what you say of me. He is that buffer zone between you and the holiness of God. And he made it okay between you and God by sacrificing himself for your sin, cleaning you up and perfecting you, so that you will stand before God perfect, undefiled, spotless. That's great language. That's all Bible language. I can't imagine me spotless. And yet that's what the Bible says. And then he also satisfied God's holiness by accepting and taking on that wrath of God so that God's righteousness and judgment has also been satisfied. Now both sides of the equation are satisfied. We stand before God accepted. And Jesus did all that by standing in the gap between us. And so he tells the Israelites, you need that buffer zone of the Levites. So I have purified them. I have taken them to myself. I have sacrificed for them so that the plague that would be my holiness doesn't touch you if you come near to the tabernacle. That's the God you're dealing with. A God who is so righteous, so holy, that people can't come into his presence unless he makes some kind of arrangement for you.
There has to be an atonement for you.
There has to be an atonement for you. Because you're
sinful.
You.
Oh. Especially you, Gladys.
Yes. Especially you, Gladys.
Yes.
There has to be an atonement.
Nobody knows that better than I.
So verse 20. Thus did Moses and Aaron and all the congregation of the sons of Israel to the Levites, according to all that the Lord had commanded Moses concerning the Levites, so the sons of Israel did to them. The Levites, too, purified themselves from sin and washed their clothes. And Aaron presented them as a wave offering before the Lord. Aaron also made atonement for them to cleanse them. Then after that, the Levites went in to perform their service in the tent of meeting before Aaron and before his sons, just as the Lord had commanded Moses concerning the Levites, so they did to them. And the subtext there that is not written is, and they lived. They went into the tent of meeting. They did the work, and God did not kill them. Verse 23, the Lord said to Moses, this is what applies to the Levites. From 25 years old and upward, they shall enter in to perform the service in the tent of meeting. Now, even among the sanctified people who God specifically chose and said that they were the ones who could do the work, now even among them, God says which ones among them can do the work in the tabernacle. You can't do it until you're 25, and when you're 50, you have to retire. I'm for this. But at the age of 50 years, they shall retire from service in the work, I love the phrase, and not work anymore. And work no more. I'm very big on that. They may, however, assist their brothers in the tent of meeting to keep an obligation, but they themselves shall do no work. Thus you shall deal with the Levites concerning their obligations. So then starting in chapter 9, God is going to recount again the rules of the Passover. How many times have we heard this? God keeps going back to the Passover and teaching it and teaching it and teaching it. That's where we'll pick up next week. And then a cloud from heaven is going to come down and occupy the tabernacle. Now that it's set up, now that it's been cleansed, now that the altar is up, now that all the sacrifices have taken place, the presence of God is going to show up to purify the tabernacle by God himself. Since his presence is going to be there, he has to purify it. And then there's going to be some trumpets put in place, because when you've got a million people or better, you've got to be able to communicate with all of them at once. And they don't have telephone, telegraph. Tell a woman. Hey, see, I didn't say it. They don't have any way to communicate, and so God's going to create a series of trumpet blasts so that Israel knows when you hear this particular series of trumpets, pull up your stakes because we're moving. And then in chapter 10, the tribes finally leave Mount Sinai. And we've had them there at Mount Sinai now for months and months and months and months and months. So it'll be good to finally get them traveling. They're going to get to the edge of the promised land. and we're going to finally get into the narrative that makes up the middle of the book of Numbers. And you've all been very patient with the chapters that were about names and counting and begatting. Mm-hmm. And now we'll move on to the traveling.
God moves in his own time. Yeah,
isn't that the truth? Yes. I wish I could get him on my schedule, but
he
kind of does things his way, doesn't he? Yeah. Any questions about that section of the book of Numbers?
I'm just so glad I was needed Moses or Aaron.
Wouldn't that be a tremendous job? That's why I keep saying, when you read this stuff, put shoe leather on it. Think about the reality of it. You know, we just kind of scanned through very quickly 12 days of huge offerings. I personally don't have the energy to butcher one bull. Any less the multiple bulls on every day for 12 days continually, and then bleeding out the blood, and then separating the carcass and taking out the innards, and then hoisting that thing up onto the altar and burning it. Don't forget, that means a tremendous amount of wood to keep the fire going. There was so much work involved.
And they were both up in their 80s.
Who was both up in their
80s?
Moses and Aaron are both old guys doing all this. Oh, yeah. And having to do all the work. I'm sure they were very relieved when God said, okay, your sons can help. Oh, come on in. And then I'll give you the Levites at 25 years old. Come on. Here's the work. It's a tremendous amount of work. That's all I'm getting at. The law says work. The law says kill things because you're sinful. That's that whole covenant. Do the work, 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 work. And then, of course, the new covenant says, okay, the work is finished. And when the Pharisees came to Jesus and said, what must we do that we may work the works of God? What is that work that God wants from us? They wanted something to do. And he says, this is the work of God, that you believe on him whom he sent. It's a completely different covenant. It's a completely different agreement. The law says, do the work and live. The new covenant says, the work is done, now live. It's a much better covenant. I'm real happy I was born now, because I like air conditioning.
Yes.
And there wasn't a lot of that in the Middle East.
I'm sure that was the last thing that the Israelites were asking God for. What can we do?
But you know, it's funny you say that, Charlie, because even amongst all of the required offerings and tithes and grain offerings and drink offerings and first fruit offerings and wave offerings and sheave offerings. And after you've done all that, he leaves open and you can bring in a free will offering if you want. And even there he said, I'm going to separate the Levites to myself, but anyone who wants to take a Nazirite vow can. So the truth of the matter is, God continues to leave open the opportunities for people to come say, what more can I do? I want to do more. And that certainly ought to be, between you and I, that certainly, I think, ought to be the attitude of those of us who aren't killing bulls and animals anymore. Those of us who are under the covenant that says, as a man determines in his heart, so let him give. I think we really ought to have the attitude of, I want to do more. Considering how much they used to do, and how little we do, we ought to want to do more.
Thank you for joining us for this week's lesson. If you would like more information about Grace Christian Assembly or the teaching of God's sovereign grace, please visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org.